The Bhagavad Gita, as most people in the room know, is actually the main text, the main scripture of the Hare Krishna movement. The contents of the Gita is actually the supreme knowledge. That knowledge which is described as the actual king of all knowledge. It is the king of all education. And that is described because it gives direct perception to the self through realization. So, knowledge itself is a, if we study what is knowledge, to know something, then we have to understand from the first principle, and that is why we need to know something. That actually should be the first consideration when acquiring knowledge, because if every one of us were perfect, and that is what everybody actually strives for, if we were all perfect, then we all would have perfect knowledge. Everybody is actually striving for perfect knowledge. Nobody actually takes any pleasure in being ignorant. So, contradictory to the term, ignorance is bliss. Actually, ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance is the cause of all types of miseries. So, this quest or this search for knowledge is a very important point. It's extremely important because it is the fundamental difference between the human species and the animal species. In other words, man is described that man is actually, could be termed as an animal. We're all animal. We all have animal propensities. The animal has a different type of body than us. So we could say that some animals are inferior. But we see that actually some animals are actually superior also in terms of eyesight. We are actually limited in our ability to see. Whereas some animals have very good eyesight, just like the hawk, eagle. They can see from very high distance, a very small mouse or a rabbit or whatever. Also, we can see that the animal has the bird has the incredible ability to fly. Just like if you went to the top of a 20-story building and leapt off, you'd come sailing down to the floor at great speed. Whereas the bird feels no fear in actually jumping off a very high building. As a matter of fact, for the bird, that's a very pleasurable experience because he has the ability to maneuver in the air, to fly in the air. So therefore, in that sense, he's superior. We can't fly in the air. We have to build a big machine. And this big machine is a very awkward, cumbersome thing. You can't exactly just have a jumbo parked outside your door or an airplane if you want to fly. So in the same way, by studying nature, by studying our surroundings, we can begin to understand what is the difference between the human being and the animal. The animal has many propensities. These are described in the Bhagavad Gita, that he has the propensity to eat. We also have the propensity to eat. Animal also has propensity to sleep. And we also have propensity to sleep. The animal also engages himself in mating and defending. We also engage ourselves in mating and defending. But the difference in one principle which you'll find different is that the animal does not actually have the ability to discriminate. An animal works completely according to the propensities of his particular body. Just like there's a very nice story of that. Of course, it's given in a story form. But there was a camel, and a scorpion. And they wanted to cross the river. But the thing was that the scorpion was unable to cross the river because it was obviously too deep. But the camel, he was able. But the scorpion wanted to ride on the hump of the camel because he knew that by getting on his hump, he would be able to cross over the river. So the camel said to the scorpion that, well, if I take you on my back, on my arm, you may sting me, and then I'll die. But the scorpion said, no, no, if I sting you, then you'll sink and I'll die also. So I promise I won't sting you. So then halfway across the river, sure enough, the scorpion stung the camel. And as they were sinking, the camel said to him, oh, why have you done that? And he said, I could not help myself. It's my nature. So this is the, we see everybody has their nature. We all say, oh, that's his nature. He's like that. But we don't really understand the mystery of actual nature. What is the, there is a great mystery behind nature. There's a great, experience. By studying nature, we can see that everyone is made up of different types of bodies, and according to their conditioning, everyone is conditioned. Just like in my body, I'm actually conditioned. I have a limited ability to see, I have a limited ability to hear, I have a limited ability of sense of touch, and sense of taste and smell. So the Bhagavad Gita is a great science because it explains everything about nature. Not only does it explain everything about nature, but it goes on to explain that what is the cause behind nature. Just like, as an example, everything, just like we see, everything has some cause behind it. It doesn't take a lot of intelligence. That if you see a very wonderful motor car, you may say to yourself, well, I wonder who designed that. I wonder which company manufactures that particular car. I wonder what is the ability of that car. So any particular item may be a wonderful display, but behind it there must be an actual brain. There must be a brain behind everything. It's stupidity to say that something simply manifests itself by accident. Because we have no actual experience that something has been manufactured by accident. Just like the scientists, they say that the universe is an accident. That the they have so many theories to try and explain how everything is coming by some chemical explosion or atomic explosion, whatever they want to define. But we have no experience where we've seen from an accident something wonderful happens. Just like I always use that example, if you were speeding down the M1 at 9,500 miles an hour and you had an incredible crash, you wouldn't wake up in Hawaii on the beach with beautiful beautiful palm trees and sun and sea. So on one hand, here is a tremendous accident, but on the other hand, what is the result? Rather, you'd be probably splattered all over the motorway or whatever. So if the universe began by accident, then we'd all be going around having accidents. Because if we can produce such a wonderful creation by accident, then accident must be a very good thing. We should all be going around having explosions. Because if explosions produced us, and it produced all of this variety, variegatedness, like the fruits on the trees, the plums, the pears, the apples, and produces all these wonderful different species, then it would only make sense that the bigger the explosion, the better the creation is going to be. But no, we see that actually accident, anything is without proper direction. In other words, anything which is brainless usually ends up in chaos. It usually ends up in some display of total chaos or madness. We call it madness. Actually, it's quite the opposite. Any intelligent man can see that anything that happens is all going on by some cause. And even scientists admit that behind every effect, there is an equal cause. That there's the law of cause and effect. So, if we're intelligent, we understand that there is a cause and effect, then we must try and understand that behind the universe, behind us, behind the body, there is some cause. And that is the real purpose of knowledge. Knowledge means to actually discriminate, to make some distinction. You see, an animal, on account of his lower development of consciousness, because consciousness, if we study, the whole Vedic civilization is based upon the study of consciousness. That's why we call it the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Because consciousness is the predominant feature of life. Just like, for instance, in my body, as long as I'm conscious of my body, there is life, there is activity, there is the manifestation of intelligence, of the mind, of the senses. But when there is unconsciousness, for instance, when I die, death is determined by when there is no longer any presence of consciousness. So consciousness is the important thing. Matter itself is actually being moved by the presence of consciousness. To give an example, just like, again, you may have this very big car, you may buy a wonderful big car, but unless the driver gets in there and turns the key, that car will never go anywhere. There's no car on the market that actually drives on its own without any direction of intelligence. You may say, well, in the future, by computerization, they may produce such a thing. But even a computer is, again, a mechanical brain, which is actually can only be operated by the computer engineer. So even if this room was one big computer, unless the scientist comes and operates the switches, there will be no, that computer will lie there for millions of years and rot away. In the same way, the mechanical car or anything will never do anything unless there is presence of consciousness. So this consciousness is actually the most single important factor in life, because it is consciousness that is searching. I'm conscious that in this life I want to be happy. Then I am conscious that there is some, superior meaning to life. So the Vedas explain that the difference, what we call so-called evolution of species, is actually the evolution of consciousness. Consciousness is manifesting itself in different forms of life. And this manifestation of different forms is actually the transmigration of the body through various species. And each species represents a particular type of manifestation of consciousness through the sensual body. And this is described very nicely in the Bhagavad Gita, that the body is a field of activity. Just like our body, all of us have a body. But what do we do with the body? We act. It wouldn't be much good having a body if you kept it hanging on a coat hanger in the cupboard, would it? If you said, I've got a wonderful body, but I'm going to keep it in the cupboard and do nothing. There's no use. No, body has to be active. Why? Because the consciousness is eternally active. This is described in the Bhagavad Gita, that consciousness is actually the spiritual presence of the soul within the body. And as I said in the beginning, that is why we call this the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, because we understand through study of Vedic literature that actually the supreme consciousness, the supreme goal of all consciousness is to understand three things. First of all, we have to understand the difference between matter and spirit. There has to be a very clear definition of distinction between matter and spirit. Unless one is able to discriminate between matter and spirit, that means he's unable to go beyond the animal platform. That's the one distinction between us and the animals, is we can actually distinguish between matter and spirit. Now the animal, he does not care about the difference between matter and spirit. All he cares about is satisfying the immediate demands of the senses. This is animal activity. Just like we see, a tiger is quite allowed to attack another animal for its food. You never find that a policeman will go out and arrest it in the African jungle, arrest the tiger, because they saw him attacking and killing a young deer or something like that. They know, we know, that animals, just like a dog, many times you see that the dogs, cats, whatever animal, they're acting according to their propensity. There's no laws that will actually, in other words, you don't find that if you go to court that you see a dog up for arrest because he was trying to, let's say, for have sex with another dog. No, we know that because they are not able to discriminate, they are completely under the control of the lower energy of body, of this body. But we see that the human being has the higher development of consciousness in the fact that he can discriminate between the body and the self. And this is the beginning, actually, of real knowledge. Real education means to actually understand aham brahmasmi. Aham means I am brahmas. I am Brahman. I am not made up of matter. Matter is a dead, inanimate substance. And without the presence of the soul within the matter, there is no activity. Just like we see that many times when someone is dying, if you go along when they're dying, then there's life and there's some degree of consciousness. But then what does the doctor say? Oh, he's slipping away. You say, he's not slipping away, he's there. And then he'll say, oh, he's gone. Where's he gone? He's in the room. He's lying there on the bed. How can you say he's gone? Where is he gone? But the doctors say, no, he's no longer there. So body is there, his eyes are there, his ears are there, his hair is still there, his arms are there, his legs are there. Everything is there. So where is he gone? And who is this he? The man may be called John Smith, but John Smith is still there. What is gone? Consciousness is gone. So consciousness is actually described in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, Deheoshminyatadi kumaram yovanam jara, that as the soul is continually passing from baby to boyhood to youth and on to old age. Jara means old age. Similarly, the soul passes on to another body at the time of death. The self-realized soul is not disturbed by such changes of the body, because he knows by realization that the body is only a temporary manifestation. Just like now, this young boy is here. I don't know what age he is, but 50 years from now, his body will be totally different. He probably won't even remember being here. So, what we have to understand is the activities of the material body are all a temporary manifestation. Just like when we were all of us have been 3 years old. Now, does that mean that if I showed you a photo of you 3 years old, that you would say, that is what you look like now? Just like you couldn't go and get a passport with a 3-year-old photo. Even though it is you, you could say to the passport officer, no, this is me. But they would say, no, it doesn't look anything like you. You can argue, no, that was me. What does it mean, that was me? Was it you? Is it you? Or was it you? That's what I used to look like. Now, I look completely different. So we should understand this point that when we were very small babies, 6 months old, then that body is different than the body we have now. The body actually scientifically changes every, I think it is 8 or 10 years. I think it's 8 years. Chemically, every cell within the body changes. So that means, actually, all of you in this room have reincarnated into another body. So people say, oh, I don't believe in transmigration. I don't believe in reincarnation. But actually, everyone in this room has changed their body completely. So you may say, but it still feels like me. Yes. The consciousness is identifying with that body. And on account of that strong identification, because the Vedas explain that there is the gross external body, and then there's the subtle body, mind, intelligence, and ego. So this ego, ahankara, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, ahankara vimudatma, that the actual fool is thinking he is this body. It's very strong words that Krishna is using. Why are we foolish to think we're this body? You can say, I know, it's a very intelligent thing to think you're that body, because you're in it. But the example is you. Just like if you were, let's say, for instance, inside a car, because you're driving very intently, you may hit another car. So immediately you jump out, oh, you hit me. But the man may say, I didn't hit you, I hit your car. But because of that strong feeling for the car, one becomes very attached to a car. If you have a nice car, of course you're an old banger, most people don't mind. They bang into you, they just say, oh, sorry about that. But if they have a nice brand new car, and they bump, someone hits them, they become very angry, very disturbed. But on one hand you could say, why are you disturbed? I didn't hit you, I just hit your car. Because on account of some attachment, the anger has come. So this attachment to the body is described. This is a hankara. The hankara means the false ego. Now, this same attachment that we have, animal also has. Animal is thinking, I am dog, therefore he is barking. He is running after this dog, that dog, barking, acting in a predetermined way. It's predetermined by what? By higher authority. Our bodies are made up of matter. Matter is described as the inferior energy of the Supreme Creator. So, that energy is also described in the Vedas as Maya. Maya means that which is not. Actually, Maya means the illusion. The illusionary manifestation, which appears to be a reality, but in actuality has no existence on account of its non-permanent nature. To give you an example, you go to, say, the cinema, you see things on the screen, but you don't take it seriously because you know it is just a temporary manifestation. So you enjoy it as some mirage, just like in the desert, the example is used, that when you go in the desert, you may become very, very thirsty. So you start to imagine water. It's a fact. You can actually see that there are many examples of this happening. And in the same time, you can see also, sometimes when it's very, very hot on the road, you can see like a water. Looks like there's water on the road, but there's no water. So this is the, given an example, that the soul is actually eternal. Nitya nityanam. Chaitanya Chaitananam, that it is that actually eternal. Krishna says, Mamaya Vamsa Jiva Loke Jiva Bhuta Sanatana, that the living entities, they are fragmental portions of God. We are all part of God. Each one of us is a fragmental portion of the Absolute Truth. And it's described that each portion, as given in the Isha Upanishad, Om Purnamada Purnamidam, that each portion is Purnam. Purnam means complete. Because the Supreme Absolute Truth is the Supreme Complete. God is complete. And that's why in every one of us there is the desire to become complete. Everybody wants to be completely happy. If I gave you a choice now, that here is an ambrosial nectar, let's say a wonderful drink. By drinking it, you will become eternal, full of ecstasy, not just happiness, ecstasy. You'll be in so much ecstasy that you'll be rolling around the floor, let's say. And that will not last just a short time. Just like you can go to the pub and get some ecstasy and roll on the floor. But when you wake up, you have headache. Not like that, no. This ecstasy is eternal. It increases all the time. And it is free from any anxiety. Not only is it that, but it is also perfect in knowledge. That, in other words, it's not a blind type of ecstasy, but it is full of unlimited knowledge. Who would refuse? Come on, honestly, who would refuse? If I actually had in a cup such a drink, and you knew that it was a truth, nobody would refuse. On the other hand, if I said to you, I have another drink in my other hand, which makes you temporary, so temporary that you can disappear, you can disintegrate, and makes you full of misery, and different types of anxieties will haunt you. Just like sometimes we have this fear of ghosts, that they may come in and haunt us. So I say that this drink will fill you full of all sorts of worries, anxieties, tribulations, miseries. And not only that, as soon as you drink it, you're sure that you will have to die. And it tastes horrible. To add, as they say, more misery, it will taste horrible. Which one you will take? This everyone can see. And not only is this a fact here, throughout the entire world it will be the same fact. Why? Because it's explained that the Supreme Absolute Truth is Purnam. He's complete. God is completely perfect in every respect. And He is also unlimitedly complete. In other words, we may have some completeness, but in very, very limited quantity. In other words, we could never say that anyone was perfect. If we're honest, we have not met anyone who is perfect. But you could say this guy is a genius of mathematics. So that could be said, that as far as mathematics can be understood, this person is complete in the knowledge of mathematics. But even then, it's a very limited thing, because we know that actually The knowledge is also unlimited. All knowledge is unlimited, because if you say that you know everything in the universe, then I may say, well, there are unlimited universes. Do you know everything in every single universe? So I don't think anyone's going to say that. So therefore, everyone must admit their incompleteness. But Krishna explains that actually the living entity is a fragmental portion. And the arrangement that Krishna has designed, because Krishna is the name for God, is there is complete arrangement in the human species. There is the highest manifestation of consciousness, available. Getting back to this point of consciousness, that we must study how consciousness is gradually manifesting through different species. Yes, we also accept evolution, but not as Darwin explained it. Darwin, his was a theory of evolution based upon natural selection, or the manifestation of different bodies according to different environment. We don't accept. We say that actually consciousness is manifested according to various levels of the manifestation of the senses in relationship with the different qualities of nature. Of course, this is a rather complex subject, but it means that nature is manifested in three qualities: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Those three qualities, if you study them, they're like the three colors. What is it? Blue, red, and yellow. Or yellow, red, and blue. So yellow is goodness, red, passion, and blue, dark, black, ignorance. So the Vedas explain that according to our association with these different modes of nature, and according to, just like when you mix the colors up very, very wonderfully, you can come up to millions of different shades of colors. Now, if we study this fact, that some of us, we act sometimes good. Sometimes we act in a very passionate way. And sometimes we act in a very ignorant, stupid way. So the Vedas explain that the different evolution of species is actually the transmigration of the soul through different bodies in order to come to the highest manifestation of consciousness, which is available in human form of life. In this planet, anyway, the human is the highest manifestation of consciousness. And getting back to this point, that there is complete facility in this particular life for us to use our intelligence, our brain, which God has given us, in order to link with God. There is a wonderful facility. Because why? Because we have the ability now to discriminate between good and evil. We know what is good. We know what is truth. We know what is right. And we also know what is wrong. And that's why these literatures, like Bhagavad Gita, these Vedic literatures, are there to guide us. By study of these scriptures, by study of these sacred texts, they're not normal material writings, just like some poet or some Nobel Prize writer. Not like that. No, these are realized knowledge. They're knowledge which is coming from beyond the actual limited perception of the minute living entities. We are all very minute. Actually, we are very proud of our knowledge. But we cannot even see our own eyelashes. Just to show you how limited. Can anyone tell me how many eyelashes they have in the room? Who can count? Come on, they're the nearest thing to your eyes. You're looking at them daily. Since how old? If some person is 30, that means 30 years, their eyelashes have been there right in front of them. And we have no clue how many are there. So that means that we are very limited. Oh, we are very proud. Oh, I can see in outer space, but we can't even see our own eyelashes. So this is the difficulty with the fragmental living entity, that he becomes very proud of his insignificant situation. Insignificant. Just like the sun. Everybody is taking benefit of the sun. And, what is the sun? Nobody knows. So scientists make some theory, oh, it's some sort of gas or atomic, combustion or whatever they want to say. But actually they have no clue. They have no clue. Because by limited perception, we cannot understand the unlimited. It is not possible. It's contradictory in even mathematical terms that you can understand an unlimited thing by limited perception. So the living entity must understand that he is limited in his sensory perception. His eyes are limited. They are also defective. We have imperfect vision. We see sometimes something and we think it's one thing and actually it's another. We have also, every one of us, we have a tendency to be illusioned. And we also commit mistakes. How many people can say, oh, I never committed a mistake? No, everybody commits mistake. So the Vedas explain that knowledge cannot be gotten by simply limited mental speculation of the mind and intelligence. It can be gotten by going to higher authority. Just like if you want to understand any subject, you must go to higher authority. Even if you want to understand, sometimes when you're trying to catch a bus, you go to the inspector. Can you tell me which bus goes to this destination? So you're accepting that man as an authority. Throughout our life, we are always accepting authority. We sit down. How many people sit down and watch the television? And we get the news. And they say, oh, today in New York there was a plane crash. How many people believe it when they hear that? Tell me who believes that when they hear something on the news? Everyone believes. Oh yeah, that happened. Yeah, today there was a terrible crash in New York. You haven't seen. But yet we see that all around there is different authority. We are accepting this as authority. Every single one of us is accepting authority. You're all here tonight because you read some leaflet or got some information that something was happening. So in the same way, the Vedas explain that if we want to understand the absolute truth, who is beyond the limited perception of the mind and the senses, then we must go to authority. Therefore Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that one must approach, just try to learn the truth by approaching the bona fide guru, spiritual master. Inquire submissively from him. Render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge because he has seen the truth. So this knowledge is coming down in the line of guru parampara system. That means our guru, he has a guru who has a guru who has a guru. And therefore, this knowledge is not something, it is descending. Descending, not ascending. It is not that by my studying that I will understand. No, I must hear. It's descending from the transcendental realm, from the spiritual realm. Therefore, it is called revealed knowledge. It is revealed because it is the highest authority that we can possibly come across. And those scriptures we see in the world, throughout the world, everybody takes shelter of some sort of knowledge. Even if you want to be a materialist, then you take shelter of mundane education, mundane knowledge. You go and get so many types of, if you want to enjoy in the material world, then you become well equipped with knowledge. Because if you're ignorant, then you won't know anything. So in the same way, everybody is taking shelter of some knowledge, of some kind. But what we're saying is that instead of one taking shelter of the temporary material knowledge, which can only give a very limited understanding, a very limited experience, and which is also filled with the four defects, and that is that we have a tendency to be cheated, commit mistakes, to be illusioned in imperfect senses. Instead of taking shelter of that knowledge, we should actually take shelter of that transcendental knowledge, which can actually give direct perception to us, to our real selves, to who we are, to where we're going, to why we're here. This knowledge can actually reveal to us the inner soul, the self. Therefore it says in the Bhagavad that Saivai Pam Samparo Dharmo Yato Bhakti Hoksaji Ahoitiki Aparti Aita Yeyapmas Prasidati, that this Dharma, knowledge, which is this knowledge, it is the highest, gives the highest benediction to Savai Pamsam Paro Dharmo. It is the supreme Dharma. What is Dharma? Again, that's a whole subject. But Dharma means, actually, if you want to determine it, in English there's no equivalent. But if you get the meaning, it is actually the function. Just like sugar, the function of sugar is sweetness. Salt is to be salty. So Dharma is the function of the living entity, of the soul. This science of Bhagavat is the supreme Dharma, because it gives the knowledge what is the supreme function of the self. Everybody is functioning, that's what I said. The body is functioning. We are functioning. What is coming from, where the functioning is coming from, it's coming from the soul. The soul is in the body, and consciousness is manifested in the body, so the body is functioning according to higher dictation. Higher dictation means that we're all dictated to. Just like everyone is blinking. If you say, stop blinking, can anyone stop blinking? You blinked, see? You nearly did it, but you blinked. So everyone may say, no, this is my body, I can do with it what I want. So I say, stop blinking. What about if I say to you now, I will give you £200,000 if you stop blinking? Can anyone do it? Alright, £1,000,000. Anyone who wants to be an instant millionaire, take up the challenge. You stop blinking for at least 2 weeks. No one can do, because by higher dictation, we must understand we are under the laws of higher dictation. Just like in society, you may say, oh, I can do anything I want, I can do. But then when you drive your car, you have to stop at the red light. You may be Mr. Rockefeller, or you may be the Prime Minister of a country, but you must stop at the red light. So does that mean that red light is more powerful than Prime Minister? That means Prime Minister is a very insignificant thing. Because she has to also adhere to the law of red light. So that means red light is a very powerful thing. It's not that, it's that the red light means higher authority. Every one of us has to be under the control of higher authority, because it is described that we are actually a very insignificant particle. We are not, we may think, we may be very proud of our position, but the Vedas explain each one of us is a tiny spiritual spark. And that spiritual spark, its real glory is in the relationship between the part and the whole. The whole means the complete absolute truth, the reservoir of all transcendental knowledge, of bliss, eternity. And when we again, this is what the word yoga means, the linking process between the small particle of God and God himself. And that linking comes through the process of, in this age, through the process of chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That chanting is actually given in this age as the most sublime method of linking the consciousness with the supreme consciousness, which is God. And every religion in the world teaches us some process of linking with God. Jesus said, thou shalt love thy God, thy Father, with thy whole heart, thy whole mind, thy whole soul, thy whole strength. And thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Muhammad also preached that Allah Akbar, that God is great, and one must be very humble, submissive to God. Therefore they bow regularly. Daily they must bow 5 times in front of God, even if they're the great shaykh. You know, in the Gulf they have these big rulers, but they must also bow 5 times in front of God. Allah. So, in every religion, there is the actual acceptance of God is great. But the Vedic literature explains how God is great, and how we are, what is our real position, who we are, what we are. And that is, we're not body, we're spirit. We're dynamic, we're eternal, full of bliss and knowledge. This body is an embarrassment, actually, to the soul. Because the soul is hankering for eternal ecstasy, bliss, knowledge. And what does it get? It gets a miserable old carcass that is just rotten away from one year to the next. That's why you see people, the cosmetic industry is huge. Why? Because people are hanging on to it best they can. Oh my goodness, it's sagging here. Let me stretch it a bit more. They go, in America especially, they go to the big surgeons to cut them, take off a bit here, off there, off there. Soon there's nothing left of them. Why? Because they're worried that right in front of their very eyes they are disintegrating. It's a cold truth. It's a horrible reality. But the body is actually an embarrassment to the consciousness. The soul is embarrassed on account of non-manifestation. Because the soul wants to manifest his eternal qualities, but on account of being covered over by material ignorance, nescience, matter, he becomes embarrassed by incompatibility. There is incompatibility between spirit and matter. Just like when you go outside, you're incompatible. Freezing cold. You don't want to freeze to death. But material nature, matter, is making you suffer. So why? So people say, why does God do that if he's so wonderful, if he's so loving? Because he wants to show you that the living entity can never be happy independently of God. Everybody wants to be independent of God. And therefore, they have to suffer inconvenience, misery. Just like the example is in the Christian Bible, that the son leaves the father and goes to enjoy, the prodigal son. He goes off to enjoy independently of the father, and he ends up eating the same food as the hog. He becomes a hog farmer or something like that, and he's eating the food of the hog, he's so hungry. And then he realizes, why should I suffer like that when I have such a rich father? So he goes back to his father, and the father, in great overjoy, he performs a great feast. So, in the same way, we are all sons of God. We are all part and parcel of God, Krishna. And we are, at the moment, embarrassed in the uncomfortable situation of forgetfulness of Krishna. So as soon as we remove this forgetfulness, this ignorance, then again, the full manifestation of transcendental consciousness comes into being. But we must get rid of the ignorance. Just like the sun is there, actually, when you're flying in the sky an airplane, you can see the sun is there. Then when you come to England, there's like 10 miles of clouds. And you get down to the airport, and you say, oh, there's no sun. Where is the sun gone? They say the sun never sets on the English Empire. It never rises. Never mind set. So that is the difficulty, is the cloud is blocking the view. Sun is there, actually sun is there, but there's no experience because the cloud is very thick. In the same way, actually God is there. He is there in his energies. There's no difference between the energy and the energetic. Because if God is absolute, then there must be no discrimination, no distinction, no duality between his energy and him. In the material world, there is duality because it is not absolute. It is relative truth. Just like if I say water, it doesn't quench my thirst. But in the spiritual realm, the absolute realm, the water in name and substance are non-different. So in the same way, God is there in his energies, but there is the covering of ignorance. That ignorance is on account of our desire to be independent. So when we remove that desire, and how do we remove it? By engaging ourselves in the service of God. That is bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga means the yoga of devotion. It is a system that by completely surrendering oneself as the servant of God, that one can actually reestablish his lost loving relationship with God or Krishna through the method of devotion, bhakti. And yoga means to link. The word yoga, actually yoke, the English word yoke, is a similar word to link, linking process. So what are we doing? In Krishna consciousness, we are linking our consciousness with the Supreme Consciousness. And as I said earlier, that method in this age is given by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra is a very simple and sublime method recommended for everyone because it doesn't require any degree of material qualification. It only depends on the spiritual sincerity of the performer in order to experience the actual meaning of the name. That the name is not different from God, because God himself, as I said, is absolute, so he must be no different. Krishna means all attractive. When I say Krishna, God is there. There's no difference. If I say John Smith, then that doesn't mean John Smith is there, because in the material sound vibration, there is the limitation, relative meaning. In absolute realm, there is no difference between object and sound of object. The name and the object are the same. So therefore that chanting, when one is calling out the name of God, and the same thing in the Christian and the Islamic religion. Why they are chanting Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, they chant on the beast. The name of Allah, because they know that Allah and God are non-different. It's another name for God. Just like in the Christian religion also, if you read in the Psalms, it says, Hallowed be thy name. There's so many mentioned that one should chant with cymbals and drum the name of God. Even that is mentioned. So even throughout the Christian religion it is there. In every religion it is there. And why? Because the fact is that every one of us, we have to, in order to be free from ignorance, from misery and suffering, we have to reestablish our connection, our relationship with God. Otherwise, whatever material, just like, again, Jesus said, what is the benefit of a man who gaineth the whole world, but loses the eternity of the soul? So what is the benefit, even if we gain so many material, external things, but we lose the eternity, the ecstasy of the soul, then we are simply lost. And you see that people, even when they have lots of money, it doesn't mean they're happy. Happiness is not external. External means that you may temporarily relieve, just like when you're cold outside, you may come into a warm room. So you say, oh, I'm very happy in this room because outside I was very miserable. That's not happiness. That's what's called relief. So in the material world, we experience so many types of relief. But that doesn't mean that we're actually happy. Happiness is a different thing. Because in the material world, if you are a relief, for some moment you may be relieved. Just like the relativity, just like if you're in the Middle East, then it's 120 degrees. If you went into a boiling hot room, it wouldn't give you any relief. It would cause you suffering. In the same way, if you are in the Middle East, 115 degrees in this nice cool room, then that would give you some relief. So it's all relative, but it has no permanence. It's not actually a truth, a reality. It's a relativity. Anyway, I better stop now. Did I? Any questions? Someone must have a question somewhere. Come on, don't feel shy to ask questions. Without questioning, you'll never understand anything.
What if people say that there's absolutely nothing absolute, everything has changed all the time?
What do people say? People can say so many things, that everything is changing. But the thing is that when in other words, you're just saying that everything is material, right? So they may have that philosophy that everything is material. But then you have to get back still to the same point. What is the cause? Original cause must be there. In other words, you're studying the activities of something. But that doesn't mean, you must know why, how it was caused. What was the cause? So that cause, that original cause, must be understood before you can actually know the effect. Studying the effect doesn't mean that you're going to be in knowledge of the cause. So you say that the effect is everything is changing. But now explain to me what is the cause from your diagnosing everything is changing. In other words, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You're saying everything is changing. So you're saying that the cause is something changing. You see? But what is the original cause? They can't explain. So really, your knowledge is not complete. It's an incomplete knowledge. And because it's incomplete, it's imperfect. And because it's imperfect, therefore it doesn't give any explanation to anything. Oh, everything is changing. You know, what does that explain? So everything is changing, that means everything is changing. That doesn't explain why you worry. That doesn't, you know, if the material concept is, well, I'm just a bag of chemicals, and the universe is just a big bag of chemicals, and we're all just a great big combination of chemicals, then why does the chemicals worry about being chemicals? You know, in other words, you say, oh, you know, everything's changing and I'm just changing. So I can say to you, all right, so I'll come and chop your head off. That's just another change. So if I chop off your head, oh, that's just another change. So why do I get arrested? Why do I have to go before a magistrate, judge, and get put in prison for life? I can say when I go to prison, I say, well, Your Honor, it was just another change. He liked to change a lot. His philosophy was, everything is changing. So I said, okay, here's another change. Off of your head. But what explanation? Does that solve anything? Or do you go to someone when they're lying in the car, they've been hit by a car, lying on the road, bleeding profusely, dying? Oh, don't worry, it's just another change. Oh, it's all changes. You know, singing around on the motorway with someone dying? No. Because changes don't actually, they mean nothing. Without understanding the reality, the cause, the effect, the purpose, you know, in other words, we're rational, intelligent human beings. We have to, we must find the truth. We have to. It's not that we can ignore. This is like the philosophy of the ostrich sticking his head in the sand. Oh, he may say, oh, yes, I've solved everything. Everything's gone dark. But the animal is coming to eat him. Doesn't stop that. So he's thinking, oh, now I've solved the problem. He sees a very ferocious animal coming to eat him. A tiger or a lion. So he sticks his head in the sand, thinking he's solved the problem. But actually still he gets that up. So in the same way, we may try to simplify matters by saying, oh, everything is material, it's all just interactions of change, chemicals, and this and that and the other. But it gives absolutely no solution to anything. It doesn't explain anything. Material philosophy does not explain anything. Just like we say the universe is coming from chemical or gases or whatever. So we must say, what is the origin? And they say, well, they bring it down to a non-definable point. What is that? A non-definable point. Mathematically, you cannot explain, they say, that point at which creation took place. But that's just all, really, is what we would call, to me anyway, it's just waffle. It doesn't explain anything. It just, all it does is avoid the issue. And therefore, we see what chaos this impersonalistic type philosophy has done to society. It's made everybody completely entrenched, absorbed in material consciousness. Everyone's totally in materialistic consciousness. Society has become so much materialistic. And what is the result? Everybody is trying to destroy each other. We look at society. What is the end result, really? Is that there is envy, greed, hate, lust, destruction, war, fighting, killing, murder. So where do they come from? They're very definable. You can define it. But they say, oh, but the reason, the original cause is non-definable. So there's no explanation there. Actually, they don't have any explanation. They may study so many things, but can they explain? Just like they say that everything is a chemical interaction or whatever, reaction or whatever. Why can't they bring life back into a body? If it's just some chemicals, then why not after all the scientific, they can actually go right down to the cells, molecules, subatoms or whatever. So if it was just some malfunctioning, surely they, by now they'd be able to bring it back. Readjust some chemicals or inject something into the person and they're back to life again. No, because they cannot explain what is that life force in the body, which is the most fundamental principle of the body, is the life force. They have no clue what it is. Not a clue. It totally baffles them. Consciousness is there's no one who can properly describe consciousness. Because they don't know where it comes from. You can study all the books you want, but they don't know where consciousness is. They say it comes from, some of them say the brain or the heart. But then, why not reintroduce it into the heart? Reintroduce it into the brain. In other words, if it's a definable object, if it's a material object, it must be a usable object. If it was a chemical, then why not just reproduce the chemical and put it back in? They say, oh, we're going to in the future. Post data check. They give you a post data check. In the future, we'll solve everything. Meanwhile, they're creating huge atomic warfare. Star Wars and bombs. To what? Not to bring life back, to get rid of life. This they're expert at. They're expert at destruction. Because to destroy something, just like an animal can often do harm, but seldom do good. See, that is the animal propensity. A dog is very expert at biting you. But you won't find that a dog is very expert at giving lectures in the university as a professor. Have you ever gone to, Harvard University? There's a big dog there. Big. It's very expert. Animal means very expert at doing all sorts of trouble, destruction. So the animal propensity is there in the human being. He's very expertly engaged in destroying each other. But you don't find that the scientists have come up with anything to rejuvenate life or to create life. They say they can interfere with life. Yes, they can interfere. Just like if I make a wonderful machine and it's totally beyond you how it works, you can be very easily able to mess it up for me, to interfere with it. But you seldom be able to reproduce it. Because it's not within your capacity to reproduce. But you may be very expert and you can say, oh look, I took his machine apart. Yes, that's what they do in the laboratory. They take this and they take this. Where are the chemicals are coming from? If they're so expert, why don't they create their own chemicals? They're taking water, hydrogen, nitrogen, they're taking this and that. They're already created by God. Let them produce one grain of rice. That's not much to ask, alright? There are billions and billions of tons of rice. So the challenge is, alright, a peanut. Let them produce one solid peanut that can be eaten and give nourishment to the body. They can't do it. Or let them produce one mosquito in their laboratory. It's not a big deal. A mosquito is a very small little thing. They can stick a few little legs and wings together, a little body, and make it go bzzz all over. They can't do it. Because it's beyond the capacity of their brain. Therefore, that is the intelligence of God. He can do it. But instead of respecting that and trying to understand higher, because they're envious, Therefore, they immediately know there's no God. It's all rubbish. It's all mythology. Actually, the reality is, we're the boss. We're the ones who created life. We're the ones who, by giving their explanation of everything, therefore that you hold them as guru in reverence. Modern society, they treat these scientists as if they're some sort of guru. But we know that actually, really, most of them are fools number one. Because they're imperfect. So imperfect means a fool. Any other questions?
What is your explanation for having so many religions in this world, like Buddhism, Christianity, Muslims, Hindus, within Hindus, many other religions to that? Why do we have those?
Well, religion is a very strange word. It doesn't really define. You see, a religion could be termed as a type of faith.
Maybe followers.
Right, followers. So their faith is something that you may have believe in. A belief. I may believe today I'm a Christian. Tomorrow I could become a Muslim. So that's a type of faith. Now, what's happened is that the Vedas explain that in this world there is actually knowledge. And this knowledge is called revealed knowledge. It is scripture, if you like, scriptures. Now those scriptures are actually given directly by the authority of God. Man cannot create religion. Not if it's going to be a pure religion. He can make so many philosophies, but he cannot actually religion, because the Vedas give a much better definition of the word religion, which is dharma. And dharma means the actual function. Now the function of something is not the faith of something. Faith is something which is changeable, but the function is non-changeable. Just like you can't take sugar and add salt and then still call it sugar. It no longer has the pure function of sugar, which is sweetness. Water is liquid. So in the same way, the soul has a function. Now that function of the soul is what we call religion. It's the soul searching for his real function. I'm trying to describe it from the... So the point is that why are we suffering? Why are we miserable? Because we're malfunctioning. Our functioning is being manifested through the body. And because of that, by the ego of the mind, we are actually thinking, I am Indian. I am German, I am French, I am Ireland, I am this, I am that. So this is called malfunctioning, false ego, ahankara. Now the real ego is the actual function of the soul. So the religion is the guideline, if you like. It is the guidance for those living entities or people who want to find out reality of truth. So now, this original, there can only be one truth. Truth cannot be many. If there are many truths, then it's not absolute. The absolute truth can only be one. And the path to the absolute truth is one. But on account of the different levels of consciousness in different countries around the world, that truth is manifested in different ways. A good example when Jesus Christ said, there is much more that I can tell you, but you will not understand. Because according to his particular audience that he was preaching to, he knew that they were incapable of understanding certain truths. Now in another country, there may be another level, just like mathematics. You go to a university or a primary school. It's all mathematics, but it's been given according to the capacity of the recipient to hear. So if the child is only 7 years of age, then you don't start teaching it higher mathematics, physics, and things like that. You keep on the simple basic things. So same way, the actual religion, and I call that religion to be revealed scripture, is, according to different time, place, and circumstances, is manifested in different faiths. Now, some of those faiths are genuine, and some are actually, they're just material. You see, religion cannot be material. If it's material, then it's not really the true word of religion. So sometimes we find that the original instruction may be a truth, and then it becomes twisted and changed by so many different interpretations by different limited people who, due to their very limited perception, they misconstrued. Just like to give you an example, in Christianity it said, "Thou shalt not kill." Now some people say that means that you can kill everything except human beings. But where does it actually say that? Jesus didn't say. He said, "Thou shalt not kill." He didn't say, "Thou shalt not murder." He said, "Thou shalt not kill." So killing is a law of God. And you cannot take life because you have not the right to take life because you have not given life. So in the same way that every religion may have very pure instruction, but it may also become misinterpreted by unscrupulous people for their own motivations. And the same in India. The original Vedas are there. And there are many, many different schools of interpretation of the Vedas. Now, some of them are genuine and bona fide, and some are misinterpretations, which will mislead the people who follow those misinterpretations. But the thing is that man proposes and God disposes. So, according to our desire, we get a certain type of a predicament or situation in this world. Just like, if I say, for instance, I want to be religious, but I don't want to give up many of the sinful ways, then I may find myself a very nice religion, which is just tailor-made for me. It allows me to do anything I like, but one day of the week I can go and tell the priest everything and it's all forgiven. That may be there. So then I remember when I was young, on a Thursday we used to have to go and we'd tell everything we'd done. So the idea of that was that you never do it again. But actually, it was, I always used to understand it, that it wasn't so bad doing it as long as you told about it. So that is a misconstruing a very important philosophical point, that if something is wrong, you mustn't do it. Not that you keep... So this is a point, that what we have in the material world, our Guru Maharaj, his spiritual master used to say that the world is full of two people, cheaters and the cheated. Two things exist in this world. Everyone has been cheated and everyone is cheating. And if we look around, we see that the natural propensity is to cheat. We all like to compromise. So, if the religious book says that you must not engage in, let's say, for instance, illicit sexual relationships. So you say, oh, this is very strong words. But actually, this word could be another way interpreted. That, I can have sex, but maybe I, can do it in this way and that way. And then another teacher comes along, and what does he do? He said, oh, you must have sex. Sex is great. Enjoy, enjoy, enjoy. Like this Rajneesh. So a big following. Thousands and thousands of people, because here is a guru, a spiritual, so we don't agree guru, but anyway, spiritual teacher, and he's saying, do anything you like. As long as you do it and let yourself go. But that's not what the Vedic scriptures are teaching. So therefore, that is his interpretation, and he may have so many followers. But the Vedas explain in great detail how you must act. So there, in India, particularly, is it said in India, on every street corner there's a philosopher.
But people like Muslims, they don't know Veda. They practice their own religion.
You see, the word Veda means truth. Veda is not although we may say, just like the sun appears in Japan, the sun is not Japanese. So in the same way, the Veda means truth. The truth may have appeared in India, but it's not an Indian truth. And then there's a Muslim truth, and there's a Chinese truth, and a Christian truth. No, there is only one truth. Reality is the truth. It doesn't matter how you see the reality from different angles. If it's the reality, it's the reality. If it's not the reality, it's not the reality. It's as simple as that. You may think it's the reality. That has no consequence. You see? How you think, that is not what determines what is a religion. You may say, my religion is the best, and his religion is all bogus. But that does not determine the truth. That's your view, and you're quite entitled to your view. But that is not what determines what is Dharma, what is religion. That comes from higher authority. So therefore, there is no contradiction between Islamic religion, Hindu religion, Christian religion, Jewish religion. There's no contradiction. The only contradiction is the way it's interpreted by various schools. But actually the truth, reality, can only be one. There is only one reality, and there is only one path to that reality. But there may be many streams coming in from different directions. Different levels of reality may be there. But that does not, you see, it's beyond a matter of what I feel or you feel. Because after all, we are very limited. So we may think that this religion is the truth. That of course everyone thinks that, otherwise they wouldn't follow the religion. But that doesn't mean that it is the truth. The truth has to be realized. Just like to give an example, if I bring you a very nice apple pie, and I say, you look at the apple pie and you think, this looks lovely. That doesn't mean it's lovely. It may be full of cyanide. So in other words, the vision of it is not the thing. Then you may say, well, alright, show me the recipe. Oh yeah, according to the recipe and the view and the vision and the recipe, it makes sense. This is a lovely pie. No. It's when you taste, crude example, when you taste the pudding and you're still alive afterwards, then you can say it's very nice pudding. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And in the same way, one has to actually experience spiritual life. It's no good. You may read books until you're 1,000 years old. But unless you have what we call vigyan, there's gyan and vigyan. Vigyan means realized knowledge. Then you can know that this knowledge is true. Realization is something which is higher than mental speculation or any type of concocted idea. And therefore, when they asked Christ, they said, how shall we know a realized person? And he said, by his actions you shall know him. Because action is the actual practice, the result, if you like, of real knowledge. How you act. You may be a very big religious leader, but if you are found in the brothel or in the liquor house, indulging in all sorts of material sensory things, then people will say, oh, he's bogus. So by the action, one can understand what is a self-realized soul. And therefore Krishna describes that, how one can see the result of actual philosophy, and that is in the action. Because words are very cheap. You may have so many very wonderful philosophical things to say, but if you act like a dog, then you're a dog. So, this point is there, that there are many religions, but we see that some of the actions of these people who follow these religions are not what is actually ordained in their philosophies. But anyone can become a true lover and knower of God by sincerely dedicating himself to a bona fide religion. It is not that God is exclusive to one particular religion, but he is exclusive to truth, to reality. Reality is the distinction between matter and spirit. In other words, Maya is the same as Satan. In the Christian religion, they say Satan, or evil, ignorance, darkness, hell, whatever you want to say. It's all part of the satanic influence. In the Vedas, it's called Satan. And in the Quran, it's also called Satan, satanic. And in the Jewish religion also, it's recognized that there are two powers working. Every religion accepts that fundamental principle of two energies working. One is good and one is evil. One is godly and one is materialistic, satanic. And there's no argument in many of the points of each religion. The Christians say that God is the all-powerful. The Muslims say he is the all-great, the all-knowing. And in the Hindu religion also, it is said, Ishvara Parama, the supreme Ishvara Parama, that he is the Bhagwan, the supreme. So the same object is being seen from many different angles, but it's only one object. God cannot be two or three people. Otherwise he's not God. He must be ultimately supreme, Godhead. There may be many gods, but there can be only one head. Godhead, because that means that that is the original. What we're talking about is the original cause of all causes that exist. Any other questions?